Hello and welcome to the LRM podcast, sponsored by Adrian Flux Insurance. I'm Martin Dominey, and Steve's not here today because instead I'm with Dan Dew from Demand Engineering. How are you, Dan?
Hello.
You good?
Yeah, good, yeah.
Thanks for having me. I'm in your workshop.
You are, and your Land Rover is.
It is, currently up on your ramp having some work done, which you will see on the LRM YouTube channel and in the magazine very soon.
Groovy.
We've been busy, haven't we?
We have. Well, although we need to be a bit more busier today, don't we, to finish it?
Yeah, I think so. There was a lot of story sharing, a lot of looking around your yard at all the interesting things yesterday. We may have got slightly distracted at points.
I don't get visitors very often.
And when you do, it's me, so unlucky.
Yeah.
But no, it's been really nice spending the day with you yesterday. I learned a lot. You probably learned nothing, but I learned an awful lot about all sorts of stuff, your history, your business, how you put together these amazing exhausts that you make and distribute throughout the world. So yeah, I just thought we'd grab an hour and sit down and have a chat over a cup of tea before we get stuck into it again today.
Yes, I'm going to work you hard.
Is that right? Okay. How did it all come about then? Because Demand Engineering is, you just make Land Rover exhausts.
We do, but we haven't always. I started with a friend in 2011, and when you go to like the bank manager and tell him that you're going to start a business, you often have to have a business plan. And it was never really in our plan to end up just doing Land Rover exhausts.
Is the dog making its bed? What, Agarus? Sorry.
When we started, when we opened the doors, we were going to do Land Rover repairs, we were going to do Land Rover re-chassis because we'd done a couple of our own vehicles, and the exhaust thing was a kind of a catalyst for these two guys who'd been friends for years to get together and have a purpose of building exhausts, but also at the same time have a bit more of a string to the company bow and do Land Rover repairs and servicing and re-chassis and rebuilds. And this was, like I said, back in 2011, and there wasn't all that many people doing it back then, so it kind of felt like, you know, it was a buoyant an opportunity and, you know, something good to get going with.
Okay, so I mean, like I say, I've looked around your workshop yesterday, and we've been crafting a fine exhaust system, and you don't do the rebuild side anymore, you don't do the repair side anymore. How did it filter down from that whole general scene into just doing, because it's quite niche, really, isn't it, when you think about it? Like,
it's really niche, come on, let's be honest.
It is but it's like, yeah, it's clearly, the demand is clearly there.
Very good.
I went there, sorry.
So in the early days, when the phone would ring, we'd are like, oh my god, the phone's ringing, you know, go for it, answer the phone. Business, you know, sort of anything, because we were so strapped for cash. So we'd say yes to everything, and we did some amazing array of vehicle exhausts, and we did loads of re-chassis. We did the first Discovery 2 re-chassis for Richard's Chassis with one of your contributors, Trevor Cuthbert, who did the magazine article, I think, for Land Rover Monthly. So that was all a bit of a publicity thing and quite cool string to our bow. We got a whole load of like-minded friends, in inverted commas. They were great bunch. I want to say loons rather than friends. They're a great bunch. I'm friends with pretty much all of them now still.
From the forum days.
From the Land Rover Addict forum days. Yeah.
Wow.
So they all came down to help, and we had some great fun times doing that. And I made some friends for life with that crowd. Oh, a lovely, lovely bunch of people. And as the years kind of went by, my business partner and I ended up sort of splitting up and going separate ways. And I sort of concentrated on just doing the exhaust side, mostly because the Land Rover side wasn't really making any money, and it wasn't what I was passionate about at the time. I was more passionate about building a business that was based on making exhausts.
Okay.
And fabricating, and that's what we went forward with. And honestly, it's been the most amazing thing. It changed my life forever. I mean, all of the things that I kind of feel are very valuable in my life, like family and my wife, and it's all come about because of making exhausts, which is kind of like it's not something you plan for. It's totally random.
Yeah, I mean, I was really impressed. Like, the scale, you don't realise, or I certainly didn't realise just how busy you are. Like, I knew you were busy because I've seen you, I've spoken to you at events and shows. And by the way, if you would know Demand Engineering, Dan's got a really distinctive 110, which is really, really cool, kind of retro style galvanised bits and big, wide, not banded wheels, are they? But they're like deep dish
wheels. They're those
Nakatenenga.
Yeah, those ones.
Yeah, 16x8, and it's just got such a distinct look. TD5 powered thing. It's really, really cool. So, you will have no doubt seen. You do quite a lot of shows, don't you?
We're going to do more this year with our new 130, which I'm no doubt you're going to ask me about shortly.
Why not now, Dan? Shall we address that now? So that the first thing that I saw really when I got here was this enormous quad tech bodied 130 with significant amounts of body cut out of it. That's your camper / show vehicle for the year.
Just bear in mind that when we bought it was not supposed to be a project. I don't need any more projects in my life.
Okay. I've heard that so many about a pound for every time I heard that.
Do you need any more projects, Martin?
Not right now, I'll be honest. Not right now. But actually, before we get onto the 130 properly, I should mention every time Steve and I talk about Land Rovers that we like and we think are like the next big thing and they're going to, you know, become quite desirable, you've got ahead of the game because you've already got an L322 TDV8. You've already got a really clean Disco 2 and, you know, and a few other nice bits around here. So
make it sound like I'm super intelligent and I've been collecting like vehicles to cos it and put in the back, you know.
You mean to tell me that you haven't thought like, future classics?
No.
TDV8, L322?
No, I just do what I like. And the Range Rover I would never have bought unless that one was the one. Yeah, that one came along and was offered to me and I bought it and it was a fixer-upper, and I'm a sucker for a fixer-upper. If you've been paying attention to any of the stories I've been telling you, I am a sucker for fixing something that's broken. I mean, that's in my nature. I'm an engineer. I love fixing things.
Sure.
And a Range Rover which turns up, which was a one owner 100,000 mile thing with two blown turbos, and you're offered for an absolute song. And you've always wanted them. I mean, me and my my ex-girlfriend used to call them like half a house, because when we bought our first house, the Range Rover was literally half the cost of what we paid for our house. You know, there goes half a house. Look,
it's crazy. And well, nowadays, a whole house.
Yeah.
Like the price of a brand new Range Rover. Although, given the choice, I think I'd still have an L322. Dan, why is there an L322 subframe on your floor? It was like, oh, that's for my Range Rover, and then we went out and had a little look around and stuff like that. But no, you've got a lot on the go, it's fair to say. I feel better about myself, to be honest. So you've done that for me, thank you very much. So back to the 130, sorry. So big plans for the 130. Single cab, box body, what are you going to do with it?
The 130 is an excuse to have a bit of fun with the company. And Chris from ORE likes to, you know, we chat fairly often, and he was ribbing me the other day. So I was saying, you know, you've got to, it's your company, you're supposed to be, you know, if you can't have a bit of fun with it, then what, you know, what's it for? And so we've got this commercial vehicle. And we are going to turn it into a sort of a bit of a show vehicle, but not in that way, not in like a shiny bling bling sort of way, but we're going to put our exhaust on it, and we're going to turn it into a bit of a camper, a bit of an overlander, and go and do as many shows as we feel we can cram in. So, I mean, instead of coming back from like, is it the Castlewood 4x4 show, the next one that we're thinking of? And then I think that's the week before Malvern, your show.
Certainly.
And we're not going to come home in between. We're going to kind of take our time and meander down from one show to the other and see a bit of the country and do a bit of, pressing the flesh, see our customers in the locale and have a bit of fun, you know?
100%. A great way to do it. Yeah, definitely. Sorry to go back to the 130. What's your vision for that then? Because obviously you've got quite a big space on the back of it, or you will have when you put the floor back in it. So is that...
It's not a project.
Oh, no. It's definitely not a project. It's just got one of those invisible floors.
Yeah, absolutely. The vision. So it's going to have a bed sort of box, a big, you know, one of those slidey out jobs where the mattresses kind of come apart and it takes up the whole floor. So it's like we bought that furniture sort of ready made. I'll have to adapt it to fit the truck, but we've bought that. We've got a couple of cupboard units which I'm going to cut down as well, which we've bought because I'm trying to cut down the amount of time I spend fabricating things. So
right,
you can buy it kind of relatively cheaper than it might cost you in time and energy to make, then that's good. And it's often good when you're doing a project to have an inspirational starting point. Like, I can't quite envisage the entire mountain, but there's this hut halfway up. And if I got to that point, then, you know, I can see how I could do the rest of the mountain, you know. So like the cupboards are like already designed. Somebody else did that. So I can adapt them and make them go, oh yeah, that's a good catalyst for this idea. And that's quite good inspiration.
Yeah, that makes total sense. I'm excited to see it. I'm excited to see it. It's a really tidy thing though, like the cab and everything. It's 300 TDI, isn't it?
Yeah, so it was done up by Dave Pickles of Paint Man.
Yes,
the Paint Man fame. He's a lovely chap. He's done new bulkhead, new doors, gearboxes, so mechanically it's pretty spot on. But he did say in his fairness that the rear body was a bit crispy, but I don't think I'd fully appreciated how ropey the frame might have been underneath the exterior. But I mean, what was I expecting? A 27-year-old commercial body built by Land Rover Special Vehicles. I mean, it's never going to be in great state after 27 years, is it?
No. And actually, I was it was eye-opening to see, because those, if you're not familiar with quad tech, it's like you could buy a chassis cab and then you could have the Land Rover Special Vehicles built back body on for, like, well, radio or commercial use, isn't it? It's like a separate back body. But the construction of it is really odd, isn't it?
They were built up for lots of electricity companies and like military applications and stuff like that, weren't they?
Yes, that's it, yeah. So, but it's like a mixture of steel, aluminium and plywood.
Yeah, it's kind of a bit, I mean, it's not the way I would do it. But, I mean, so they've, from what I can tell, they've taken this phenolic, I think that's how you pronounce it, phenolic plywood, which is like a plastic impregnated plywood that people call it buffalo board as well, you know.
I know what you mean.
They make trailer decks out of it and
stuff. Yes, yeah.
So they've got a piece of that and they've like mounted it on the body supports, and they've made like a metal frame at the front for that, and then they've built the body kind of all on top of the piece of ply.
Right.
So the front's aluminium kind of web and then a skin, and the roof's the same, like an aluminium web and then a skin. And then the sides are like steel, C-shape, like thin steel box section. And the back is box section, again, the same in steel, but it's all mounted on the piece of ply, which is then mounted on the body.
Structural ply.
Structural ply.
Yeah, it is surprising to see how they've gone about doing it. And I'm not an engineer, but yeah. So a bit of a job on the go, but you'll see it at the shows this year. Isn't that right, Dan?
You have to. Otherwise, Laura's going to, you know, have my guts for guard.
So, going back, you briefly mentioned that you're quite good mates with LRM contributor Trevor Cuthbert, aren't you?
Trevor and I go, yeah, a few years back.
But how did that come about?
That was through the forum, through Landrover forum.
Okay. Those of you younger listeners that might be listening to the podcast, the forum is like Facebook, but on the internet, like on the websites rather than actual Facebook.
Yeah, so I mean, like, I don't know whether how would you describe it, but it's like a website where you log in. There are loads of forums still about. I mean, I'm a member of the Full Fat Range Rover forum.
Oh yeah, that's a good
great. And these places were a great wealth of knowledge. Yeah, Defender 2. Yeah,
and Angry Pumas was a forum, wasn't it, before it branched off to Facebook and the clubs and everything.
Right, okay. I think I applied to join Angry Pumas and they turned me down. Ian sort of suggested I should like watch these threads about, you know, how the exhaust and the tuning was going.
Okay.
And then Ian Bourne of ILB.
Yes.
And I think I applied for Angry Pumas and they turned me down. They said, oh no, you haven't got one, so you can't be a member. I was like, oh, I get them.
Okay. Politics.
But Land Rover Addict was like a really broad spectrum forum, which I think Trevor came up with, and it was really easy to use. And there was all a bunch of, you know, lovely people on there. And it was those forums are brilliant for like community knowledge. It's like a library. Like, you've got a problem with like an alternator or you know, your Lander is all starting, and you went to put this problem on a forum page, and like a million people would go like, have you tried this? Have you tried that? And you'd be like, okay, that's a great idea. Or they'd put on like pictures of their project and stuff like that. And I had, funny enough, another 130, which I'd bought. And this is way before demand engineering. This is when I was being an agricultural contractor. And I'd rebuilt this Landro with an idea of turning it into like a specialist vehicle. I didn't tell you this yesterday. I had this vision in mind of this 130 doing a specific job. And it was all based around my then wife's horses and this horse habit that she had. And I didn't realize, but you had to go around fields and pick up horse poo.
Yeah.
You know that? Have you heard that?
I've heard of it. It's not something I've ever aspired to do, but I have heard of it.
So I thought, well, you know, I could do this like off-road road sweeper, like as a whole vehicle. And I was going to turn this Land Rover into this like essentially mobile poo picking service.
Okay.
With this front mounted hydraulically driven brush and then a tipper body. And I'd like take the brush off and put it on this little trailer, and I'd drive around with it, and I'd offer this service where I went like once a week to all these horse owners and did their fields for them.
That's actually a great idea.
Well, I thought so.
Why didn't your massive pooper scooper Hoover thing come to fruition?
Just because I kind of got busy with life, and you know, it's sort of like how many good projects or good ideas have you had, and then something else comes along. And to be fair, I had so much fun building the Land Rover. I kind of.
So is that the 130? Because you actually had a cover, didn't you, on LRN? Was that 130?
That was Kev Mills' first cover story that he came and did. He came in and sort of brought a photographer down, and we drove up and down. He took photos of it and put it in the magazine. On cover, yeah. We looked at it yesterday. It was 2013?
Yeah, it was a while ago, wasn't it? Kev will probably be listening to this, because I know he likes to listen to our ramblings as he drives around the country in his lorry moving lots of big, heavy things. So
yeah, I love watching his steam engines. He's so into
it. He's got some really cool stuff, hasn't he?
Yeah.
And very cool Land Rovers.
Yeah. All those series.
So the 130 actually evolved from that idea into something a bit different, didn't it?
Well, it didn't really evolve any further, but it became like a Swiss Army knife. And because I put hydraulics on it, and it had this three-point linkage I designed for the front end, and it was a tipper anyway, and I used it as part of my dad's contracting business, and I put a tachograph in it, and so it was like towing trailers, and I'd get in it, and I'd drive down the A14, and I'd be towing a trailer with it at 3.5 tons, and so you've got this Land Rover which is like 7 tons all up on a 300 TDI, and you'd overtake the lorries just about on the flat. And then every time you'd get to a hill, like all the lorries would come thundering past you. And you'd be like, oh, this is embarrassing. And I just kind of, from that, I even started doing my own VNT conversions on Land Rovers. And it was something we'd offered when we started demand engineering. And I copied an idea I saw on somebody else's. And it was a VNT that came off of a VW LT35 van.
I've heard of this, yes.
And you sort of switch it from being...
They were vacuum to boost controlled, weren't
they? That's it, right. You switch it from vacuum control to boost control, and you can use a little boost controller, and you can tune up the 300. And I got some amazing torque out of it. I never had it on a dyno, but it was like I was really disappointed with like the traditional method of tuning your TDI back then, which tended to produce a lot of smoke.
Yeah.
And it didn't really produce a lot of go, but I felt like when you're driving a commercial vehicle and it's producing a lot of smoke, you're just attracting attention that is really unnecessary. And it's antisocial as well. I mean, it's just, you don't need that black smoke in order to produce power. It's not an engineering requirement to produce huge amounts of black smoke. Yes, it's fun, and but it's not like, it's actually just unburned diesel and sort of, you know, waste products. It's not efficiently being burnt. It's not like really creating, harnessing the power of the fuel. And I then started playing around with the 300 and driving to Wales with it and towing, and I tried all sorts of different intercoolers and different radiators because I had temperature problems. I then melted the head bent halfway down the M6. That was funny enough, picking up a Discovery with a gearbox in its boot that I bought to rebuild for my wife. And so I'd learned about EGTs, exhaust gas temperatures, and the melting point of aluminium, and I put an EGT gauge in my 300 TDI, And I mean, this is back in what, I don't know what year it was. It was like late 2000s. So it was pretty early on in the Land Rover tuning TDI sort of era. I'd quickly discovered that my tune that I had set up by somebody else was producing EGTs well above the melting point of aluminium.
Right.
And I was like, well, no wonder the whole thing's struggling, you know, sort of, you know, if you've got EGTs, which are, I think the rule of thumb is like the melting point of aluminium is 650 degrees. And I was easily producing with no load, no trailer, like EGTs of in excess of 850.
Wow.
And for like a short time, like all the tractor pulling boys out there will probably tell you, oh, that's no problem. I mean, I've seen 1300 degrees on the gauge, but for a short period of time, that's no problem, of course. But for an extended period, like Detling Hill in Kent, for instance, towing a trailer, or some of the Worcestershire Malvern sort of hills, towing a 3.5 ton trailer on tachograph, it's sort of like, yeah, that those EGTs are too high for too long. So I kind of got into this whole world of tuning, like old school tuning before computers, and it was really interesting. It was really interesting, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And it gave me a real good understanding of the constraints of induction systems on Land Rovers and exhaust systems, and you know, porting your cylinder heads, and all about essentially taking this, what is a large air pump, essentially an engine is a huge air pump. You're taking atmospheric air and you're sort of combusting fuel inside it and you're pushing it out the back, you know, and the more efficiently you can do that, the more power you can safely create, and you know, the longer lived your, or under stressed your engine will be. And there's nothing like a woefully underpowered 300 TDI towing a 3.5 ton trailer, and itself is 3.5 tons, going down the A14 for 4 hours. You know, it is. That's when you really start to notice that whether your tune is any good or not.
100%. Yeah, I was going to say, I remember those. I had a 200 TDI as my first car, and I remember scrolling through the various pages on the internet of how to, you turn the diaphragm and adjust the star wheel and adjust the little torque screw at the top and then the maximum fuel screw on the back of the V's pump. And I was like, I'm a tuning genius. And then you go down the road and it's like, I can't see where I've been. And I don't feel like I'm going much faster. But no, there's a very fine line. And TD5 obviously is now, and TDCI to a point, is, you know, that's a completely different stratosphere of sophistication when it comes to tuning. So,
yeah, ECU tuning. I mean, it's made the world a lot more easier to comprehend. But you do put a lot of faith in the guy who's driving the computer, that he's got the experience and reputation, and he's doing what you're asking him to do. And I honestly, from my experience, there is such a different world of tuning a vehicle if you're going to, you know, be putting your dogs in the back of a 90 and going to the beach every afternoon and you know, going shopping. And the other end of the spectrum is that 300 TDI that's running 7 tons up and down the motorway. You know, there's a completely different school of tuning thought, and not one shoe fits every scenario.
That's exactly what you explained to me yesterday when you were talking me through the range of exhausts that you do and the options you can have silencer-wise and things like that. Like something that might be fun, well, in your words, something that might be fun for 5 minutes, you'll hate after X. You know, if you're running to the pub in it every, you know, a couple of weekends a year or whatever, then go for it. But if you're actually going to drive it every day and load it up and use it hard, you perhaps don't want it to shout in your ear the whole time.
So exhausts, oh my goodness, the Land Rover world of exhausts are interesting, and lots of people ask me this also. They say, I've got this engine, it's like a 2008, it's a Puma, but I really don't want it too loud. And I'm like, well, hang on there. I mean, it's never going to be too loud. I mean, it depends on which perspective you're coming on, because sound is very subjective. It's very about like your personal, you know, experience of the exhaust. But that's also very much tailored to the vehicle, the body style,
yes, what
you've done with it, and what you are doing with it. So like what you've done with it in terms of other modifications, what you're going to do with it. So if you're going to sit on the motorway in your 90 and you're regularly going up and down the motorway at 70 miles an hour, and let's say you're driving around in a van back with no insulation, I mean, if you've ever heard a bass drum on stage, I mean, you're essentially driving around in a bass drum. So your experience of the sound in terms of the exhaust, you've got the worst scenario because it's all happening and it's all being amplified by the empty space behind you.
Yeah.
And if you're going to sit on the motorway, you're probably already thinking it's quite loud. So my advice at that point would be like, well, what are you doing with the car? I reckon you need to be thinking cautiously about having what people call a straight through exhaust, you know, with no silencers. You know, let's think cautiously. Let's err on the side of caution. And you kind of go, well, are you 25 or are you 45? I mean, how do you feel about it? Are you an aging rock star or are you, you know, have you got your hearing? How do you feel about it? So it's all very subjective. It's all very personal. And yeah, that's kind of fun, but it does make it kind of a little hard sometimes to set up people's expectations with what is possible.
Yeah. Like you say, I suppose when people are looking to buy or order one of your exhausts, it's sort of, you might have a preconception in your head of what it will sound like, how loud it will be. But the truth of the matter is, until you buy it, fit it, you're not going to know. So your sort of experience and your advice, listen to it, because the last thing you want to do is spend, you know, your hard-earned cash on a really beautiful exhaust and then just think, why have I done this? Yeah, I should have got a silencer.
That's true. But I mean, if you're into your history and your analysis of things, there's personal bias. And I'm mostly like in my mid-40s, and my experience of how loud I want my exhaust might slightly taint my advice that I give to you.
Okay.
So I've got to try and be impartial at the same time.
I see what you're saying. Yeah. Not thought about that.
So, I mean, you might think, you know, a TDI with no silencers on at all is like the best thing since sliced bread. And in your world, that's not very loud.
When I was 17, it was. I used to drive around with my 200 TDI with a standard downpipe straight through middle section and the back box in the back of the tub.
Yeah.
Because then it would bark and you'd drive through built up areas, put it in fourth and, you know, foot to the floor and it would be like growling. And if you ever got pulled over, you could just say, oh, sorry, my exhaust just fallen off. That's why it's in the back. But now I don't think I'd be that same person.
Yeah, as you, your tastes, your requirements change as you get older, or as you experience different things.
Yeah, 100%.
Like if you've got your kids in the back of the car, or your missus, you know, they have different expectations, and that might not be very important to them. Whether it sounds like it's you know a Ferrari driving around down the road. I mean, by the way, a Land Rover is never really going to sound like a Ferrari.
No, no, that's very true. Yeah, I was kind of not nervous, but I was trying to think hard about what I wanted from the Series 3, because the exhaust is the last piece of the puzzle, really. Like, we've finished the rebuild on the Galve chassis, it's painted, it's all new suspension, it looks fantastic under there, but the rusty old exhaust was just not doing it for me. So you're sorting that out for me, which I'm incredibly grateful for. But I didn't want it to be louder. That I said I don't want it to be louder than it is fast, because it's only a low compression 3.5 V8. I didn't want it to be shouting from the rooftops, performance, when...
Yeah, obviously, and you're getting older. I mean, look at
the greats. Look at... Steve's not here to defend himself, but he's stressful to work with, Dan. Bless him.
So your experience of your exhaust, you were in a truck cab.
Yes.
Right?
See, I was interested. I never would have thought about this. This is a real gem.
Your truck cab is the most naturally insulating, that's the word, body style between you and your exhaust. I mean, if you ignore the noise coming from the engine bay and probably all the other rattles and squeaks that your Land Rover's got, a truck cab will isolate you from the sound the most out of all the body styles on a Defender or a Series. The least isolating, in my experience, is like a soft top. Like you say, right, our TD590 that Laurie and I bought, we bought it as a pickup and we converted it into a soft top. And for the first few years we had it, every winter we'd like take the soft top off and put the truck cab back on.
Right.
And suddenly the exhaust that was actually, frankly, it was too bloody loud in the summer. It was, you couldn't hear it at all in the winter. And I that thing's had so many exhausts because we've used it as a bit of a development mule. And like, I've run it around with like straight 3-inch on with the truck cab. And you know, it would be absolutely all right. I mean, people in the street would kind of turn around and look at you as you're coming in, because they can obviously hear it. And it's like, I can't really hear it at all in the cab. Whereas we put it on as a soft top, you can't hear yourself think, you know.
I would have thought, weirdly, that a hard top would be louder than a soft top, because a soft top at least absorbs a bit of noise.
I don't know. I haven't tried a direct to
back comparison. I suppose, I mean, I hadn't thought that a truck cab was particularly quiet until you mentioned it, but actually I can totally understand that. Yeah, it same way that you put the heater on in a truck cab, and it gets warmer a lot quicker than...
Well, you're driving a V8, I mean, it's all...
The floor does the warming. The floor... It does a fantastic job. The bulkhead is a radiator, essentially. Yeah, very
good. And you'll find the floor is becoming a radiator.
Yeah, yeah. That's one thing you did mention, is I should probably wrap the front section to sort of protect.
It just gets quite tight, doesn't it, going over the gearbox mounts. And, yeah.
There's a bit of finagling to do on that, because of it's the wrong engine in the wrong chassis, and there's a bit of, you know, tweaking to do. But we're getting there.
I've done a lot of wrong engines in the wrong chassis.
Okay.
A lot of them.
You were the man for the job when I thought this needed exhaust. Because actually, I got put onto you years ago when I had the Freelander that I turbocharged, so the 1.8 petrol Freelander that I turboed, and I drove it around like standard, 200 horsepower tune from K-Maps, and I thought, this could be a lot faster. I'd gapped the piston rings, so I knew the engine was capable of doing a lot more horsepower than it was at the time, because I made sure to future-proof it when I put it together the first time, and I thought... I bought all the bits, bigger turbo, bigger intercooler, bigger injectors, everything. And I thought, right, I'm going to do this. I'm going to take it off the road and I'm going to make this as close to 300 horsepower as I can get it.
We're proud to partner with Adrian Flux, an insurance broker that specialises in covering all types of Land Rovers, including classic, ex-military, modified and Q-plated models. Adrian Flux offers a range of optional extras to make the policy your own and can provide cover for off-roading, green laning, agreed value, and build-up cover. Plus, they even offer a discount of up to 15% for Owners Club members. Simply search Adrian Flux Land Rover Insurance for more information or call them directly on 0344 728 0417 for a quote.
Who can make me an exhaust that can handle that? And, you know, within the confines of the body. And I put it on Facebook, and Drew Wright
said, Drew, yeah,
you need Dan at Demand Engineering. And that's how I first became familiar with you. And unfortunately, when the Series 3 came up, the Freelander had to go. So I never actually got to the point of doing the work myself, although I'm told it is actually in its new ownership going to be heading towards that goal soon. So maybe I'll pass on your information. But yeah. You can blame Drew for that.
So I can do pretty much any exhaust for any car. We have specialised in Land Rovers, mostly because we've got oh my god, you never expect this. It sounds really pretentious, but we've got this worldwide thing going on now. We watched a video of one of these guys. I think it was in South Africa somewhere, you know, and he'd had so many views and we'd not even heard of him, and he was like bigging us up, and we sent a few exhausts to South Africa, and we sent a few exhausts down there, and he was bigging us up and saying, oh, Demand exhausts, they're the ones to have. We're like, oh my god,
you are a worldwide brand.
We sent them all over the place, honestly. We sent them to north of the Arctic Circle. I mean, the guy rang us up, really nice guy. He's on the Outer Hebrides somewhere. He invited us to come and see him. And I was like, yeah, we'll go.
Too right.
So we'd find the time. And he's saying, is it going to cope with like minus 25 all the time? And I'm honest with everybody, you know, oh, I don't really know, but I can't see why not. So we sent one north of the Arctic Circle. We sent them down. We sent a couple down to the Falkland Islands.
Wow.
We recently sent one to Guyana. We sent them to Aruba. California, I mean, they've gone as far as Australia and New Zealand. All points of the compass.
All over the shop.
It's not like we were talking about before. It's not like a business plan you set out to do. Like, oh, I'm going to send them all over the world. You know, you can't just speculate and life happens. And, you know, I'm sitting here amazed going, how'd this happen? I've no idea.
It's ideal, isn't it? It's like you say, the quality speaks for itself, doesn't it? But... Well, let's talk about what trips you've done with Land Rovers in, because you've been out and about a lot. You've seen stuff.
Have I seen stuff?
I think so. I'm looking at pictures around your office. I'm like, that's cool. That's cool. That's cool. There's a lot of pictures. You like pictures?
I do like pictures. I like being reminded of what's important in life. And I'm really passionate about getting out there and having adventures. And, you know, I've really admired people like Ben Fogle and Jimmy DeVille, you know, and yeah, out there. I know you and Jimmy did a thing. I've done a thing with Jimmy. He's actually, there's an exhaust somewhere around here waiting for him at the moment.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, him and Ian are getting together to do something, but that's probably a secret. I probably shouldn't say anything.
Oh, it's okay. We'll leave that there. But I was going to say, yeah, Jimmy DeVille was our first podcast guest ever. What a guy to kick off with. But yeah, and the quality has stayed the same since then. We aimed high and we've achieved it. But
he's like a guy who really grabs life by the horns.
He does, 100%.
And gets out there. And I really appreciate that. So, I mean, we haven't done, and you say we've been out there, we haven't done a huge amount of adventuring as a Land Rover. We like getting out in the caravan with the kids and... we have towed our caravan with the 110 all the way up to the Mull of Kintyre a few years ago, which was great fun. It was when that, you know, remember all the, like, holidays and planes and flights, all that went through the roof for a brief period, and everyone kind of did these staycations instead. And we looked at it and we kind of mapped it out and we worked out how much fuel it was going to take. And, like, well, should we spend 600 quid on flights or should we just spend 600 quid on diesel? And we ended up spending 600 quid on diesel. So we dragged the caravan all up to the Mull of Kintyre and stayed this little place, literally with like the sea was like a stone's throw, no exaggeration.
Wow.
And we saw like the sea otters and all the wildlife on the west coast of Scotland. And it was always just magical, but it was brilliant.
Awesome. Yeah, that sounds very, very appealing indeed. But I was actually, I saw another photo a little while earlier this morning of your Disco 3 that you used to have with all your kids waving from it, bikes on the roof and the caravan behind it. And I was like, if that was ever a picture of what Disco 3 was built to do, that is it.
The D3, yeah, oh my God. You know Laura's a keeper when, within the first 6 months of me and her getting together, she financed us buying that D3. And I kind of had this idea that we were going to use it as development for the company, you know, for an exhaust system.
Right.
And... although we did do that, they never really took off, and it wasn't really a thing to modify your D3 much back then. But she financed buying us this D3 off my cousin, and we had a hell of a lot of adventures in that, you know, because the kids are like, I think they were like 11 and 8, and we had the D3 for about 3 years, I think. Oh my goodness, it cost a lot of money to keep on the road. Before that, I had an old knackered Volvo, which I absolutely loved. It sounds like a really old man car, and then a Volvo, which I really love. But I bought it for nothing, almost, and it had 205,000 miles, and everything was just... I felt like it was Brucey Bonus, you know. Oh, yeah, we made it all the way to, you know, Northamptonshire. Brilliant. Well, no problem. You know, it hasn't cost me hardly anything. Whereas the D3, I mean, we worked out it cost... I think it cost like 8,500 quid over 40,000 miles.
Yeah, it's not cheap motoring, is it?
I mean, I loved it. It was a great, you know, really kind of made you feel special every time you drove it. But once you do those kind of sums, I mean, maybe doing those kind of sums is just like, don't do those. You can't do those kind of financial mistake. You know, don't do those.
Steve would call his £1,000 car because not because it cost £1,000, but it would cost him £1,000 every time it went to the garage.
Yeah.
So yeah, I can see how that would wear thin after a while, but it hasn't put you off. You're still Land Rover through and through.
How many we've got? We've got 5 at the moment. I have had more than that.
I was going to say, yeah.
I've had...
it feels 12, like more.
I had 12 at one point.
Yeah, it's funny you should say this, because one of the first conversation points was, you reckon 3's the ideal number of Land Rovers. I disagree. You've spread your wings, and there's a lot of them about, isn't there?
I've got the company owns a couple of them. We've got a 90, a 110, a 130 now.
You've got all the wheelbases.
Yeah, all the lengths. You've got to have one of each, like a full house, you know. We've got a D2, which is a van.
Oh, I love your D2.
Commercial from factory. So that's, I think they're becoming quite rare now. And that hasn't done astronomical miles. Like, those of them would have been worked really hard. And the L322, so that's
okay.
That's 5. So I've kind of covered most of the bases. I did have a Freelander briefly, but it went with the ex-wife, so
okay.
I haven't replaced that. But
fair enough. Fair enough. Yeah, it sounds like you've got enough on the go anyway. Like, one of each wheelbase is great. I wonder.
they're not all on the road though. I mean, that's, you're making it, I mean, like, they're not all like taxed. I mean,
yeah.
And you've seen where I live. I mean, I only live like 4 miles.
Some hibernate. Yeah. That makes
sense. I've only 5 Land Rovers when I, you know, live 4 miles from work. You just don't.
No, I get that. But the D2's great. I really like the D2. It's that, yeah, they're just so understated and like, we get an unmessed with one. They're just cool. And I think like what we said before on here, they're getting a real following and the values are reflecting that.
That's because you keep bigging them up on this podcast. That's what
we don't know. We have no influence.
Yeah, right.
But no, they are. They're really good. If you find a good one and you've got the money in your pocket to buy something of that size. Yours is still on air as well. I was impressed. The rear suspension's still air sprung.
They're delightful on there.
They are very good.
On there. I had an ES V8 on LPG before that.
Disco 1, yeah?
No, Disco 2.
Is it Disco 2?
Yeah. And I bought that. I'm a sucker for a fixer upper, and I bought that locally, and it had a gearbox in the boot. It's the second Discovery I bought with a gearbox in the boot.
Right.
And I was like, oh, I've done a gearbox before, you know. And we had the ramp in the workshop, you know, we had the tools. So I was like, oh, we could fix it. No problem. Found a secondhand gearbox, put it up in there, did the exhaust on a V8, which is always a good thing. And we used it as the company tow barge for about 6 months until this commercial got offered to me. And I was like, am I really going to swap an ES with all the leather and the ACE and air and all the rest of it? Am I really going to swap that for a D2 commercial TD5 manual, you know, two-seater?
Yeah, kind of a downgrade on paper.
It was like a tractor versus a supercar. It was like, you know, that ACE system's brilliant. It's a great piece of engineering.
It really is, actually. Like, people sort of... its sort of existence has been marred slightly by the fact that age happens to it and the pipes go rusty and fail. But
yeah, but you can fix it up with... I fixed mine up with like traditional hydraulic compression fittings. So you go to like anyone who does like hydraulic hoses and equipment and stuff like that, and I just made up some hydraulic lines with a bender and I queued them in like you do with like your plumbing in the house, you know. Well, it isn't actually that hard to fix. You know, mine did rot through in one of the usual places. But I think there was a huge number of stories about people buying all of the new pipes from Land Rover, and it was like astronomical money. And
I would imagine they were astronomical money to buy, and having fitted a few sets of ACE pipes on Disco 2s and Range Rover Sports in my time, they're not a job you'd want to do on the driveway with pre-shaped pipes. They are horrible.
Yeah, I could believe it. I could believe it.
But when it's working, it is a phenomenal system.
Yeah, yeah.
I like watching we were saying to Greg King when he was on the promotional videos of when the Disco 2 first came out and ACE was introduced, and it's like, you watch one go round a corner without it, and it's like a jelly, like wobbling,
yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah,
drunk, whatever. And then one with ACE, it's amazing how flat they do corner. I remember actually when I was an apprentice at Leamington Training Centre, they had a few like ex-test cars that they go and do. You'd get like laps of the track and things like that, and this particular instructor, who was known for being a bit of a loon, just tips this Disco 2 in without even touching the brake or backing off, and it just goes around, just went around the corner, just 70 miles an hour, switch backs, and it was just mind-blowing. 7 up in this Disco 2. Yeah,
they'll corner as hard as the tires will let you corner it. Yeah.
Incredible engineering.
My first Disco, I had a 200 TDI Disco, which we bought when the kids the kids came along, because we had a 90 before that, and 90s aren't overly kid friendly, not for child seats and, you know, all the rest of it. And so I bought this. I actually bought an X-Taxi on three. It had a minor shunt, and it had one of its front wheels sort of hanging off.
This is definite, yeah.
But they don't have anti-roll bars, and by the time I'd rebuilt it and put it together, it was like, oh my God, this is like driving a blancmange. I can't get over how bad this is compared with the 90, which was like, you know, on point, even without anti-roll bars.
They're a bit roly-poly, the early Discos. They ride nicely, but they are like sailing a ship. But you had quite an interesting Disco one, didn't you? You were telling me about.
Oh, what, the 5 litre?
Yeah.
Like, I'm a sucker for a project, and, you know, a bit like you, I found out, I'm often thinking about, oh, well, that's an interesting thing. I could do that with this. And, you know, I'm like, probably like so many people out there, you know, almost like mentally slightly unhinged. I'm constantly thinking about opportunities and possibilities. And, this I had a run of 300 TDI automatic discoveries that we'd be using as a family car, and I really fell out of love with them after a trip to Wales camping, because it was just each to their own, but I found it just a dreary driving experience.
Okay.
And I came across a V8 XS that had been on LPG, and LPG was like a kind of a big thing. The government were kind of pushing it, I believe, at the time, and you could get LPG kits for your V8s and like get the fuel almost half price. And it made like a V8 almost affordable to run.
Yeah.
I mean, how many times can you say that in your life that you had a V8, unless you're very wealthy? I mean, running a V8 is a daily. I mean, how extravagant does that sound?
I know. Back in the day, you're 100% right. There was all sorts of studies, wasn't there? And it was big in magazines at the time. I remember it was like, you could, essentially, you're running it for the price of the equivalent MPG, or the fuel saving makes it up to the same MPG as a diesel.
Yeah.
You're like, why would you not?
Yeah.
But sadly, LPG seems to be dropping off now.
So I bought it was much cheaper than the 300 auto disco that I'd fixed up. Again, that was the first one I bought with the gearbox in the boot. I found this XS on gas and picked it up locally, and I drove it home, and it just whooshed along. You know, you just kind of like, you're doing, you know, 60 miles an hour. You just want to go slightly faster, just squeeze the throttle just ever so slightly. And it doesn't even bother changing down. It just goes, and it purrs up to 70 miles an hour. You know, it was like a driving experience that was chalk and cheese compared with the TDI automatic.
They are a bit wheezy. I dailied a 300 TDI auto for many, probably 5 years, I think I had my last one for. And I actually did like it. I've even on slightly bigger tyres with the, I got used to it, and I was like, yeah, it's cool. I don't share your disdain for them, but I can totally appreciate if you're going from a V8 to one.
If you're kind of going from the whooshy, like loads of power, like, you know, you've got the prestige of a Rover V8, which, let's face it, is whichever way you cut it, it's an amazing engine with huge heritage. You've got that kind of whooshy, kind of delightful noise, and you've got the power, the torque that's on tap. And like, I think there's something to do with the stall point in the torque converter, isn't there?
Yeah.
300 TDI doesn't like the torque points don't match.
Yes.
So you don't really get a huge driving, like, positive experience from it. Whereas the V8 was just blissful. Anyway, so I got hooked onto that idea of running a V8 on gas. So I got rid of the 300 TDI auto, because by the V8 on gas was just beautiful. I'm not really a fan of D1s, honestly, but I found this like, oh, this changes everything, you know. And I was doing the whole eBay cruising thing, because like, I do that a lot as well, sort of going through like, well, what's these worth? You know, what's that? You know, oh, look at the price of that. They're not very much money anymore. And I'd come across spares and repair, and I was doing like a lot of spares and repair searches, and I found this Discovery one, again, local, and it was a 5-litre V8. And I'm not certain the guy really knew what he had. Maybe he did, but it was, it turned out to be a JE Works, JE Engineering, completely modified Discovery 1. And of course, a 5-litre V8 is never going to be great on fuel, and this wasn't very good on fuel. But it turns out to be a Rover V8. So it was like, I believe when I looked it up, I spoke to John Eales about it, and it wasn't a John Eales engine, because he's legendary in the VA world.
100%.
But I spoke to Johnny, he was on the phone, about this engine. It turned out it was just after he sold JE Engineering, or he wasn't involved in JE Engineering anymore. But it was a few engine numbers after that. So it started life as a cross-bolted Morgan-destined V8.
Oh, wow.
And it had been bored and stroked. And I think it wasn't... There's like an American brand of engine maker where you put the crankshaft in that and it stroked it. So it was taken out to 5-litre, and it had these very rare safari cast manifolds on it, which were bigger in diameter.
Right.
And I think they called it like the fast road spec 5-litre. For ages, you could look at the spec online, and then I stupidly didn't print the page out, and then they took it down and I couldn't see it anymore. But it was dynoed at 305 horsepower for a Rover V8, which is amazing. And this Discovery kind of came into my life, and I went to see it and I drove it. The brakes were all knackered, and the exhaust was like, you had this double quad sort of thing at the back. You had two exhausts on one side and two on the other. And this is like a 1994 MREG D1. in Burgundy, and it had been lowered, and it had like super stiff anti-roll bars that had been grafted on, and I was kind of agog at the idea that this sort of real old school, almost American fied sort of like, but like the old sort of Overfinch conversions,
yeah,
you like put a big American V8 in it, and I saw this thing, and we came to a deal, and I came home with it for effectively a soul these days, and I was like, that engine is just glorious, and I put it on the road. I did the brakes, put it on the road. We went on one holiday down to Cornwall, and for a 2 week holiday, it drank 600 quid's worth of petrol, which is way before our 600 quid trip to the Mull of Kintyre.
Yeah,
to 55 towing. This was just the car.
Just poodling about. Wow.
And I think I worked it out. It was doing something crazy like 12 miles to the gallon or something. I mean, it was just so expensive. Not on gas. It was just on
petrol. Petrol, right.
And I was like, I'm a crazy young man, young family. You can't, this is, so I parked it up. And I feel like now, you know, those projects that got away from you, like, oh God, what would that be worth now?
Yeah.
You know, and I ended up scrapping the body shell because it sat around for ages.
Right.
I rescued the axles off of it. I rescued the brakes because I'd done all the brakes. I put all EBC brakes on it and everything to match the power. You know, I thought, well, you better have some decent brakes on it. In the end, I ended up scrapping the body shell, but I kept the engine and gearbox, and that was the first engine and gearbox that was supposed to go in the, well, it did go in the 110.
Okay.
That 5 litre V8 is a pretty special engine. And I ended up selling, I only sold it last summer to a friend of mine over in Suffolk who's had it rebuilt since.
Oh, brilliant. I was going to say, so was it a full conversion by a company, or was it just an enthusiast, do you think, that put the engine in and bolted it together themselves with the
axle? No, it had JE Engineering stickers in the disco. It was I don't know whether it was rather, like a wealthy customer who'd spec'd it, or whether it was one of their works cars that they'd done as a just demonstration. But I mean, it was
very cool.
Very cool.
Yeah. Rarity. You do occasionally see, you mentioned Overfinch. In fact, there was an Overfinch Discovery for sale not that long ago, and I thought, God, that's an interesting thing. I bet there's not too many of them kicking about.
So talk about rare cars. We had, I mean, it's only rare in certain worlds, but the guys from Blackbird Industries were doing some work on this Overfinch 110. It turns out to be the only Overfinch 110 pickup that they ever did.
Oh, right.
We had that in for an exhaust here, and that had the crazy Overfinch works, and there was a magazine article. I'm gonna send it to you. I've got photographs of the magazine article.
It's something I'd be interested in seeing.
So. Yeah, so apparently it was this, from memory, it was this guy down in like Brighton somewhere, or Hastings, somewhere like that, and on the south coast, and he owned like an amusement arcade, and he needed something to move like machines around on his amusements, so he spec'd up this massive like spec pickup. But even then, it wasn't fast enough for him after we had the Overfinch treatment, apparently. And he put like a bigger engine in it and a more capable gearbox and had it lowered even further and stuff like that. So it's like the only Overfinch that is pickup that they made. And then it's been furtherly modded to be even faster and more powerful. And the guys at Blackbird were doing like some upkeep on it, trying to bring it up to spec, make sure it was running properly.
Right.
And we ended up doing an exhaust for that. I've got some video of that. It sounds pretty epic.
Yeah, I'll have to show me that later. That sounds cool. That sounds right up my street. Cool. All right, let's just do... If you could... You've obviously owned quite a few Land Rovers in your time. You've still got a few kicking about.
Just a couple.
If you could only have one for the rest of your life, what would it be?
Oh,
sprung that question on me out of the blue, haven't I?
Awful. You can't ask me that. They're like, you know, you horses for courses. You got one to do different things. If I was only going to have one, you know which one it's going to be.
I've got a good reason behind it.
Unfortunately, it wouldn't be any of the Defenders, which I love, but it would be the Range Rover.
Yeah.
I mean, I know that they come with an image, but I mean, I always like struggled with the image of a Range Rover.
Do you not think, though, that they've become, I think, to be fair, with the help of people like Jeremy Clarkson and Harry
Coe's Garage, anyway, that guy.
Yeah, they've sort of become. Perhaps when they did have the slight image thing, they've sort of become. If you see one now in good condition, you're like, yeah, it's definitely an enthusiast car.
Those L322s are more farmer than footballer.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
what that's the phrase I've kind of got.
The
to.
Sport was the took care of the footballer image, I think, didn't it? That was yeah. aimed at them. The L322 was definitely a little bit more country gent, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Harry Metcalf is his name.
And the one I've got is a 3.6 with the, it hasn't got the digital dash, it's actually got the clocks on the dash. And so it is the same era as Jeremy Clarkson's one.
Yes.
And I feel like that was, like, I agree with him. Like, it's peak Range Rover for me, because it hasn't got any of the emissions devices on the bottom. It was before they started to mess with that side of cars running. And okay, it's got lots of technology and it can be quite hard to keep on top of it with an older car. But I mean, it's like heated leather steering wheel, you know, double glazing. I mean, not many people realize that they've got double glazing. And, you know, if you've 14 speaker sound system, and, you know, you can stand in your kitchen window and push a remote control and it will defrost the car. And, you know, you go to it like on a winter's morning, it's all steaming and completely, you know, no free of ice. I mean, that's just luxury. That's luxury.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. And such good value now, if you get a good one. Yours is...
They're so hard to find that haven't been, like, footballed up with, you know, black alloys and...
Oh, yeah, trims and... That's it. The disease that is the Chinese stick-on crow, which seems to plight, and 22-inch, you know...
And mine's parked up, let's say, face it now. Mine is actually... I took it off the road because the rust is getting...
Yeah.
Quite bad at the back.
But that seems to be, unfortunately, something that is not killing, but certainly... incapacitating a lot of Range Rover L322s come MOT time, the subframes and the back of the sills and the arches, they are starting to go, unfortunately, aren't they? But
so it's, there is a Land Rover after all, so I mean, I'm gonna,
that DNA just takes longer to come through, but no doubt you'll sort that out at some point once you finish with 130.
I'm in love with that car, like you said. I would take that anyway. It does everything so brilliantly. I would, you know, you sit on the motorway and we did a run down to Devon recently because my daughter was down there doing a course, and you know, you've got 300 odd horsepower and you're trugging along, and it averaged 36 miles to the gallon.
Yeah, you can't sniff.
A 3.6.
Is yours remapped?
It got an economy remap. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, just phenomenal. Love it. Absolutely love it.
They're brilliant cars. 100. I will.
Steve's going to disagree with me. I know he is.
Probably will. He's not here, though, so we can big up L322s all we like.
I'll let him have a go in it.
He'll change his mind. I think they're fantastic. I will have one day, but the Freelander 2 is just hanging in there at the moment.
The Freelander 2 is like a baby Range Rover, isn't it? I mean, they're very good cars.
They're high. If you get a high-spec one, they are... Yeah. Again, it's hard to ignore the value you get, like heated screens, heated seats, panoramic roof, Alpine sound system. Like, it's kind of... Like I said, I keep looking for reasons to change mine, and it just, I can't find any, unfortunately. If I needed to tow more weight or carry more stuff, then I would. I'd go for perhaps a D4 or an L322 is more likely. But I just can't. It just keeps being such a good daily user. I just can't get rid of it.
One of my really good friends who loves his Freelander, he's actually moved on to an Evoque now.
Okay.
So we're calling him sort of, you names wise. No, we're not. They're good cars. He's liked his Evoque, but it's like a Freelander on steroids. Did they use it to replace the Freelander? No. Discovery Sport or something.
Discovery Sport replaced the Freelander 2. Evoque was the same underpinnings as the Freelander 2, essentially, but with a prettier Range Rover style body on top. So underneath, the early ones are very similar architecture wise to Freelander 2. So they're probably quite reliable as well. Until they went to Ingenium and the 9-speed auto, which was a bit cantankerous.
There's been some random engineering introduced to cars of late, honestly.
We were talking about this earlier, weren't we? The fact that, I mean, you're far more qualified to comment on it than I am, but the modern stuff is just, I don't think I'd go there.
There are some decisions, like we've been developing the internal combustion engine as a society since like the 1900s or something, or even earlier than that. And I don't think a lot of people realise that, I might be wrong, but it might be Mercedes, or not Mercedes, but Daimler-Benz, who owned Mercedes. It might have been them that invented the electric hub drive motor. And we're talking back in like the 1930s or something. And they had a decision to make back then, like 100 years ago, to decide whether to go forward with electric propulsion back then, or they developed the internal combustion engine. And And we've been developing it for years and years and years. What is wrong with us that we come up with some of these engine designs recently that just can't, you know, oh, 70,000 miles. Well, let's just change it. It's gone bang.
We've definitely
have a word with ourselves.
Gone 100%. We've gone past the point of that beautiful blend of emissions, performance and durability. We're way past that now. That's gone. That's a distant memory. That's peak automotive engineering. We're too far the other side now. We're worrying too much about emissions and performance, and the longevity's gone out the window. No one cares.
Yeah, and there's an argument to be had, isn't there, about what's greener? Is it more greener to run an older vehicle that's sipping on fuel, that is lighter? Okay, you could argue that it's not got the safety equipment, and you know it's not, but it's not wearing out tires at a huge rate. It's not wearing out brakes at a huge rate. The servicing's less involved, but and it's already paid its carbon dues in its manufacture. Is it greener to run your old banger into the ground, or is it greener to switch up for a newer vehicle? And we go back to this horses for courses thing for me, in that it makes a lot of sense to run electric vehicles in urban areas, in sure, highly densely populated areas. Of course it does. Look at the logic of it. You're talking about air quality and air pollution and health. But like, biggest problem for me is that you've got road freight. All of those hundreds of thousands of lorries that are on the road. We've got Felixstowe Docks just over here, one of the bigger, busiest ports in the country, if not the busiest port in the country. All of those lorries, there is no way you can electrify all that road freight.
No.
It's just not going to be feasible.
No, it's application specific, isn't it? For sure. But that's a whole other subject.
It's a completely different.
We'll come works, back and do another
one. Well, I'm an advocate of, you know, fixing old stuff.
Am too. I was just keep what you've got going, because it's worth it. You know, it's, I always say, better the devil you know.
How much satisfaction do you feel driving around in your Series 3 knowing that you've done every nut and bolt in it?
Yeah.
You know every bit that's put together. You know, like the bearings and the wheels, you've checked those, the fluids, you've checked. How much satisfaction do you feel like knowing that you know where you're at?
It's brilliant. I love that. I love that Land Rover. It's like, especially now spring's coming, you're getting brighter, the sun's out, you cruise along in that and you just think, yeah, this is cool. And you get so many like looks and... I think people appreciate it. It's such a rare sight now to see anything of that age, certainly, but anything older, especially in like rush hour traffic. People just, it's like it's an alien's landed. Like,
do you get little kids waving to you as you drive?
You get kids looking out windows at you and things like that. And it's like, people, oh yeah, I remember my dad used to have like a petrol station talk and stuff like that. And it's just nice, especially with the, you know, it is dialed in now. It just drives so nicely. I just love using it.
That's one of the reasons I love the Land Rover community. I love working with like all the commercial trades people that we know and we have a relationship with, and the people that we've met like vicariously around the world, like the, you know, people that who invite us on like safari tours with them. You know, Laura gets chatting with people. She's not here today, but she gets chatting with people on the phone. She has like, you know, we get like Christmas cards, we get like WhatsApp videos from people who you know bought one exhaust from us, but we've had this relationship which has blossomed, and they're like, you know, they're now pals and they're sending us all this stuff, and it's delightful, honestly.
It's the delightful. best community, I reckon, of any vehicle brand. I think Land Rover people are good people.
Yeah, I mean, I could have been a VW guy, but you know, I ended up being a Land Rover guy.
glad to hear it Dan. Thank God. Right. We need to wrap this up because we've got work to do.
Yeah, come on, let's go build an exhaust.
Let's go and do exhaust things. Well, I'll watch you do exhaust things. But yeah, cool. Well, thank you ever so much for having me. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
Let's crack on.
I'll stop rattling away and I'll go and do some welding.
Thanks very much for listening. Leave us a little rating or a review. Don't forget to follow us on our socials and check out the LRM YouTube channel, because there's loads of fresh stuff coming to that. And of course, please do buy the magazine. Dan's a subscriber.
Of course.
He appreciates quality when he sees it. See you next week when Steve will be back. Normal service will be resumed. So thanks for listening. Catch you later.
Bye for now.